It's surprising to me how many people have tried this and failed spectacularly, and mostly with leaf blowers for reasons I don't quite understand.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another episode of Bad Voltage. This is Season 1, Episode 8. I'm delighted to be here with my good friends, Mr. Brian Lunduke.
Say hi, hello. Hi.
Big Stu.
No, absolutely not.
Stuart absolutely. Language, say
thank,
hello.
Thank you. Hello, yes.
And of course, tiny, tiny Jersey Shore, Mr. Jeremy Garcia. How are you doing?
It just doesn't get old for you, does it?
it doesn't go not cold once. For anyone, Jeremy.
Continue on to Kembe.
All right, okay. So, Ak, what are we going to be talking about on this lovely show?
Well, one of the first things we're going to talk about during the show is we're looking back at Back to the Future 2, the predictions they made for 2015 and how wildly inaccurate they were.
We're also going to do an interview with Matthew Garrett, well-known in the open source community for his views on UEFI, common contributor to the kernel, etc., and random fruit fly scientist as well.
And we'll also discuss whether gun control can solve the problem of gun violence.
And then we're going to finish the second half of our brand new, amazing 2014 prediction segment where Stuart and I try to be as wildly inaccurate as possible.
Hi!
Let's be honest, that's pretty true.
Mine are absolutely dead on. You'll all eat your words a year from now.
My prediction is that you're going to be wrong. So, Jeremy, I'm unsure. Like, what should we be doing right now?
And now, Bad Voltage.
In 1989, Robert Zemeckis directed a film called Back to the Future 2. And one of the interesting
things... One of the greatest movies ever, by the way. I just want to get that in there. Well, it's fucking incredible.
To be clear, it is tragically the worst of the series of three, but...
Shut up,
bullshit.
I hate it.
That is just categorically untrue. By the way. Really? You think that the second one is better than the third one? Really?
Yeah,
better than
the third man, one? The third one's pretty bad.
Guys, let's not fight amongst ourselves. The Back to the Future series, they're all good. Let's just get past this, all right?
It is like picking a favorite child. Anyway, carry on.
Also, Brian appears to have become Jono and started mediating debates now.
When it comes to the Back to the Future series,
the important thing about this is... All right. Film came out in 1989, and one of the key things about it, looking back on it, is the fact that it predicted a whole bunch of technology for 2015, right? Which is only next year now. So we thought we'd take a brief glance at what they were predicting the world of 2015 would look like and see just how accurate they were.
Now, to be clear, this is roughly 2 years away because we're going for November of 2015.
Such a gimp. Can't believe you knew that.
That is both impressive and disappointing at the same time. I think my dad said that to me once. Why don't we go through this maybe just one by one and pick out some things from the list. I'll start off to get things going. So obviously I'm going to pick the hoverboard, right? I mean, this is the most important technology that's in that movie. And from what I can tell, I did a little bit of Googling earlier on, it is nowhere near to being invented.
It's surprising to me how many people have tried this and failed spectacularly, and mostly with leaf blowers for reasons I don't quite understand.
I mean, right. I think that's the really important part about this, you know.
Come on, when you look at a leaf blower, you think immediately, ride it.
What the hell is a leaf blower? Anyway, right, the key thing about the hoverboard, unlike the rest of the stuff, yes, I have also gone done some research, and a lot of the stuff they predict doesn't exist, as you'll see when we get there, but potentially could do it, just no one saw it was worthwhile, or got overtaken or whatever. The hoverboard, not only does it not exist, no one even has the first idea how to go about making it.
Well, to be fair, there was some art dude who created a floating hoverboard. It looked like a hoverboard, and it hovered. but it was, you know, in one place and you couldn't ride it. I mean, the concept of making something hover isn't hard, but the concept of it being as cool as it was in Back to the Future 2, you know, from what I can understand, you can hover on something and move, but it requires a massive hovercraft.
Right. It can either have a huge air cushion, or me, like everybody else, I've managed to balance one fridge magnet on another without them touching one another, and maglev trains exist. This is light years away from being a skateboard that could go anywhere you like except on water.
So unless from one huge power air cushion to another, Ack, what are you going to pick?
Well, the next thing on my little sub list of things that not only don't work, but we have no idea how to even go about making them work, is the holographic billboard, right? Marty's walking through the town square, huge, great big Jaws 3D shark comes out of nowhere, right? It didn't work in 1977 when they did Star Wars and had a little mini hologram of Princess Leia. It doesn't work in 2015 with a huge Jaws. No one has the first idea how to make it work. It's ridiculous. TV's convinced also, we should be able to do this, and we just can't.
I also love how in Back to the Future 2, the image quality of that shark that comes out looks like a PlayStation 1 game.
It's horrendous. Yeah, I mean, we've cracked in mid-air holograms, but unfortunately, we only allowed 15 polygons to make
it. Guys, polygon count and high definition is not everything. Guys, come on.
All right, Lunduke, what are you going to pick?
Dude, the obvious one, the most scientifically and culturally significant advancement in all the Back to Future franchise, and that is the dust-resistant paper.
No,
I'm just putting it out there.
Dust-resistant paper.
They have dust-resistant paper. Then you don't need book jackets. How awesome would that be? I mean, that would really change all of our lives, and I'm a little upset that it's not here yet.
Do you spend significant portion of your day dusting off paper?
Don't you?
Well, you know, he's got to sell all those crappy books that he makes. Right?
Oh, wow. I quite like the idea of getting this stuff.
They make
dust-proof
paper.
Making...
It's called an e-book.
But yeah, I was going to say, what I want to do is I want to get this stuff and then make a case for my Kindle out of it.
Jeremy, what have you got?
You know, originally I was going to say they really did nail the video glasses pretty closely from a time perspective. But considering the one I'm going to pick is considering I'm in New York right now, and the high temperature for the week, I think, is not. I'm going to go with that automatic dog walker because that would be amazing to have.
Dude, right?
Why that doesn't exist, I can tell, I'm not sure.
Does not. From what I can tell, the closest we've got to that is one of those dog leads that makes it look like you've got an invisible dog.
No.
Which is kind of the opposite of an automatic dog walker.
There'd be nothing stopping you taking, for instance, a Honda Azimo. The robot thing, right? And sending it out to walk the dog?
That's a pretty firm investment in a team walking your dog. I mean, just pay someone to go and walk your dog for you.
I can see there is a difference between, you know, something which theoretically exists and costs $700 million and something which is on sale in Best Buy. But nonetheless, it's considerably closer to existing than dehydrated pizza is.
Dehydrated pizza does exist right now. Just when you rehydrate it, it tastes like garbage. You can get
it tastes like dehydrated
if any college kid can tell you, if you order something from Domino's, get one of their $5 hot and readies, and you leave it on the kitchen counter for about 3 weeks, you've got dehydrated pizza. You just don't necessarily want to eat it.
Right. You don't want to eat any pizza that's not from New York State, to be fair. I've had pizza in quite a few states, and I don't know what your guys' problem is, but it is total and utter rubbish how bad pizza is.
Whatever.
The key point about the dehydrated pizza in the film is that it was the size of a coin until it was rehydrated. It wasn't just a perfectly ordinary pizza with the texture of boot leather.
Also, rehydrating it does not include pouring beer onto it as well, from what I can understand.
Do you know, I actually...
Within the student
context. Wait a minute. You guys, they did not specify what liquid was used to rehydrate it in the food rehydrator. It could have been beer.
I don't think it was. Technically,
you are right, yes. Black & Decker might have put out a product which pours beer onto a dime and makes a pizza out of it.
would be so rad.
I love how, by the way, speaking of which, I was about to reference Black & Decker as well. It is not a company I would associate with future technology in 2015.
No.
It's like, and you can buy it at Sears as well,
you know? part of the thing I kind of thought was funny about this is there's an interview with, I believe it was the director, who said they actually explicitly didn't try to make scientifically sound predictions because they didn't think it was interesting. They just tried to be funny with the predictions, and some of them have actually come true, is I think the irony to me.
Yeah. What, there's a couple of things, though, that they that were in the movie that I would have expected to have been invented by now. So, first of all is power lace in shoes, right? I mean, For the Michael J. Fox foundation thing that he did. Do you remember, like, a couple of years ago, they made the Nike Power Air shoes or whatever they were called.
They didn't have the laces.
But that
well,
to me
Nike
seems
actually
like,
did file a patent in August of 2010 for self-lacing shoes.
Right, really? I'm surprised at that. Yep. I mean, it seems like a fairly solvable thing. But and the other thing as well is
one of the fans made a pair that kind of works. Not really, but
really.
You just
the other thing as well is the neon curbs. I'm surprised we haven't seen neon curbs. I mean, they look cool. They actually, you know, it seems fairly simple to do.
They
don't look
cool. They look cool in 1989.
Dude, if it looked cool in 89, it looks cool now. That's how 1989 works.
I forgot how many fax machines were in the movie, too. They really thought just everything was going to be faxed in 2015, which is astounding.
I'd forgotten that.
That's true.
That's a good point.
Actually, for this episode, we don't want feedback to come in through the forums or through email. We would like them faxed.
we would like it faxed to us. Oh, man. To be honest with you, the most unrealistic thing about it, you remember when Marty picks up the grey sports almanac, yeah?
Right.
Well, he bought it with Bitcoin.
Yeah. And as we're discovering, anyone who makes predictions about Bitcoins is going to be wrong. So,
that's
how that works.
not the that's only one.
Very nice segue, sir.
Yes. So there we have it. You know, that's what we think. I think we will accept some feedback on the forums, see what you think. Is there anything we've missed out? That, you know, I mean, there were things like the mind control video games, and there was the adjustable bat. That was a good technology. What do you think? Come and go to community.badvoltage.org and let us know about what technology in Back to the Future 2 is likely to be invented in 2015. So now on the show, we've got Matthew Garrett, longtime friend of each of us and of previous podcasts such as Lug Radio, but very first time on Bad Voltage. How you doing, Matthew?
I'm pretty good, Jono. How are you?
Very, very good. Thank God you're here. So for those people who don't know who you are, you're a longtime contributor to The Kernel, very well known in the open source and the free software world, and I believe you're at Nebula now. So why don't you give us a quick one-minute summary of some of the things you've been working on recently, what you're doing at Nebula?
Okay, so one of the main aims of the product we produce, which is a cloud appliance, is a thing you put in a rack, you plug a bunch of servers into it, you turn it on, and then it's instantly a cloud. But one of our main concerns is security, and we want people to be able to depend on cloud environments as if they were depending on physical servers. We want them to be able to trust the machines they're running on, even if they can't inspect them directly from their guests. We want them to be able to inspect them externally to verify that nothing has compromised the systems, no guests have broken out into the underlying system and then compromised guests from there, that kind of thing. So been working on all kinds of security-related things, mostly integrating SE Linux more tightly with OpenStack. But in addition, using things like the TPM, the Trusted Platform Module, which allows you to get cryptographic verification of the state of the system as it boots. So you know that it booted the kernel you expect it to boot. You know that it booted the NMRFS you expect it to boot. And then building a chain of trust from there, which means we can say, yeah, this device booted all the correct software. Nothing got in there and booted some compromised software first. So we trust that machine. We are willing to run guest operating systems on it.
Right, gotcha. Now, one thing that some people know, but not a lot, maybe many of our listeners don't know, is that your academic studies have been largely in the area of biology. Like, you were studying fruit flies or something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how did you, what, like, that seems like two very different things. What attracts you to fruit flies in preferably a non-sexual way? And what attracts you to doing very, very low level engineering work?
So the bit of science that always appealed to me when I was back in school was using genetics as a way to make sense of very complex things. We could look at something that, you know, 100 years ago we didn't understand at all, and we could say, you know, based on our understanding of genetics, we can explain how this happens. We can make predictions about the future. So genetics seemed like a really nice bit of biology where things actually worked instead of being all kinds of squishy and gooey and confusing and doing whatever they wanted to do. So that sort of took me through my original degree, and then I started to stay on, do a PhD doing computational analysis of genetics. So take an even more rigorously logical approach to genetic analysis. Whereupon I discovered, of course, that everything I'd learned up until that point was lies, and nobody had the faintest idea what anything was doing at all. Any pretense that this was logical or made any sense was just nonsense. As I was going through there, I had a lot of computing background. I was interested in using computers to solve problems. I just got to the point where I was starting to spend more time using computers to solve problems with computers than I was using computers to solve problems with genetics.
And I mean, a lot of people have been intimately aware of your work on UEFI recently. Where do you think the situation stands there? I mean, you've been quite outspoken about some of these topics, but where do you see the situation there?
I think that the situation we've ended up with with regards to UEFI secure boot stuff is about as good as it could have been expected to be. We've ended up, in almost all cases, ensuring that an end user with no prior knowledge of Linux is still able to install Linux on their computer without having to reconfigure the firmware, without having to jump through additional hoops to do it. And that seems like a benefit. And better, we've ended up in a situation where the end user still has the freedom to choose what their computer runs. If they want to run a Linux that just works out of the box, they can do that. But then they can also remove all the keys and leave their system able to boot anything. Or alternatively, they can install their own keys, and then you end up with a system that only boots software that that user has explicitly chosen to let their machine run.
Right.
Now, that makes sense. I mean, you're talking about security there. One of the questions I had, this is related to the talking to LCA, I think. If you look at, you go and buy a modern machine, then an awful lot of the code in it is not actually available to you. You've got the firmware, you've got all the system management code, so on and so forth. In the light of all the Snowden stuff and the idea of the NSA stopping your laptop halfway to it being delivered to you and poking new things into it, is that worrisome? And is there, more importantly, is there anything we can do about it? I mean, if I'm interested in buying a machine which I can be confident hasn't been compromised in that way, what do I do? Do I complain to HP? Do I wait for Bunny to build his completely open source laptop and buy one of those? What?
There's kind of multiple levels of this. The first is, if you get shipped a completely unmodified system, is it then possible for the NSA or any other powerful third party to take control of it and see your stuff? And the question there is, well, yeah, like you say, we can't see a bunch of the code. We have no idea whether there are backdoors deliberately built into it. And we also have no idea whether there are accidental backdoors that's been built into it. Yeah. So I tend to lean more towards thinking that most manufacturers are not putting deliberate backdoors in for the use of the NSA. I think that the risk of an enemy gaining control of the same backdoor would be too great. You would need to build something very subtle, but also from a PR perspective, you would need to build something very deniable, difficult for anyone to find. And that's a fairly difficult thing to do. It would be, if someone were to find that if you ran a very specific sequence of instructions on an Intel CPU, that the random number generator suddenly changed its behavior, that would be a huge problem for Intel. no one would ever take them seriously again. They'd never be able to sell a CPU. Yeah.
The smoking gun to end all smoking guns.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, you probably don't need deliberate backdoors in those cases because we're pretty bad at writing software still. And we look at how many security updates you have on a Linux distribution any week. Some number of those could be used by an intelligence agency to get in. And all they need is to find those first. But that kind of accidental backdoor is something that is much easier to deal with if we can perform security updates of our system, if we can inspect the code ourselves, look at all the plausible ways that someone could attack them and fix them. So I think open source firmware for laptops and open source system management code, I think that's vitally important. And it does continually sadden me that no big vendor has been willing to be the first to stand up and say, we are going to do this because we believe it's a better way to produce a platform. And it's in the interest of us and it's in the interest of our users.
It's not even big vendors, is it? Right? I mean, if you want a machine with completely open, inspectable system management code, you can't buy one, can you?
That's not entirely true. There's a couple of cases where core boot is now sufficiently good that you can boot Linux on actual shipped laptops. And there are a couple of vendors who will sell you laptops which have had the firmware replaced with core boot. It's not still entirely perfect because the embedded controller, which is a small microprocessor on the side of the system, that is still running non-free code. That hasn't been replaced yet. And that could normally... These days, your keyboard controller is implemented on the embedded controller. So an attacker could potentially have a backdoor built into the embedded controller that recorded your keystrokes and then flash them out on an LED in response to some sort of specific input, for instance. So there's still some uncertainty there, but it's a step forward, and I'm really pleased to see people working on that.
You know, Matthew, you said something in your LCA keynote that really resonated with me, and I just want to quote it real quick, was, do not allow conversations to be about reducing user freedom in order to improve security. Challenge anyone who says this and ensure they know it's unacceptable. Now, I very much agree with that, but why do you think that is such a common misconception, and what do you think we can do to kind of change that moving forward?
You know, it's partly, we always sort of see this as, if you build a house and you put a lock on the door, then that improves your security. And, you know, it doesn't really limit your freedom in any practical way because you control that lock and you put it there. But when we do that with computers, we tend to see it as, well, the manufacturer has put that lock there in order to protect us. And we bought this computer from the manufacturer, so we should trust the manufacturer, because if we can't trust the manufacturer, why are we using this computer? And so the users are willing to accept that loss of freedom and that they no longer control some of these locks because they see that there is an improvement in security. And that's the straightforward, easy way for a manufacturer to do it. They can just say, oh, we'll restrict our systems in this way, and then security will be improved. And that's true. But you've lost that freedom. You've lost the ability for the users to implement their own security model on the system. So, for instance, if I buy a secure boot system and it doesn't have replaceable keys and it boots Windows, if there's a flaw in the Windows bootloader that lets someone take over my system, I can't fix that because if I replace the bootloader, the system will stop booting. So there's this perception of increased freedom, but there's not necessarily of increased security, but there's not necessarily as much increased security as you'd like there to be. And in some cases, there can be reduced security. So you've lost this freedom, but you've also not necessarily gained everything you wanted. Whereas if you ensured that you implemented it in a way that provided user freedom as well, the user has the freedom to use your security model if you want to, but also to build on top of that and ensure that they have a more consistent security model that aligns with their own interests.
Wonderful. Well, Matthew, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you so much for coming on the show. And you know, I think all the other guys will agree with me when we say that, you know, we're really appreciative of all of your efforts in the open source world and everything you do to further Linux and free software. So thanks for coming on the show and all the best for the future.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
in the discussion now, we're going to talk about whether gun control can solve the problem of gun violence. Now, this is obviously an extremely divisive and very emotionally charged topic.
Nah.
And one thing, no, not at all. And one thing that I think that became just immediately clear to me after doing a little bit of research for this segment is there are widely varying, sometimes diametrically opposed, but seemingly well-sourced numbers and statistics available on both sides of the debate.
Yeah.
And that makes this discussion really difficult for me because I'm a person that really likes to base things, whether it be decisions or whatever, on data, right? I'm a pragmatist. But I think the other side of it for me is I'm a person that really thinks it's worthwhile to take kind of the long view on things, right? I'm willing to make a painful short-term decision if I think it's the correct decision for the long term, whether that be in my personal life or not focusing on, you know, quarters to quarter results for a business. And why I lead with that is I think that events, take Sandy Hook as an example, they're tragic, right? They're visceral. And because of that, they're easy to get emotional about. And I think those emotions can lead to reactive and sometimes short-sighted regulation and laws. And laws that are made out of fear, laws that are rushed through without really fully considering the unintended consequences they may have, and laws that in the end, well, they may be well-intentioned, they don't actually solve the issue. And on the topic of the issue now, I think personally, and here's where I think we'll start to get some debate, I think this is a discussion that has to be broken up really into two discussions, right? Mass shootings and non-mass shootings, because I think they're two distinctly different issues with different root causes and different solutions, right? To me, mass shootings is not a gun control issue at all, really, but a social one, right? Budget cuts recently and social stigma and other really cultural components, I think they've led us to massively undervalue social workers, social work in general, and just that social net and its ability to really identify and treat those with mental illnesses and, or sociological issues. And this is, mass shootings, I think, are one manifestation of that failure. The other gun control issue, I think, is a separate topic, and I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, so just to, you mentioned, Jeremy, about how you can often see radically different numbers. Just to paint a bit of context before we get into it around mass shootings, because I think that's, you're right that a lot of people associate the gun debate in many cases with preventing, obviously, mass shootings.
Yeah.
According to Slate, there's been 9,900 gun deaths since Newtown, since the Sandy Hook Newtown shooting. And that article was published in October last year. So it's a little old as well. Now, I saw a different article that suggested that there's 21,000 deaths. Quite different numbers.
I saw one where there were 6,000.
Right, exactly. And but I went and looked up. I was curious about how many school shootings there's been. And in 2013, there was 31 school shootings in the US.
Something
and there's
like
already
that,
been 11 this year.
Yeah.
So
way too many.
You can't deny that. Now to put that in context, they're not all the size of Sandy Hook. Some of them, one person was killed. At Sandy Hook, there was 20 odd people were killed. But the point is that there's a lot of mass shootings happening, which is obviously a bad thing. And just to follow up on that, I think the issue is, again, I think it's a mixture of the access to firearms, but also the access to mental health care and treatment. Because anyone who goes into a school and shoots a bunch of kids, there's no doubt about it that they've got mental health issues.
And I think in most of these cases, when people look back, they say, yeah, we could have seen that coming. It's the exception when it comes out of the blue, I think. And a stronger focus on social issues in general, I think, would
Which was part of Obama's changes that he wanted to bring, right? It was better access to mental health care, and I think it was this month they just strengthened the background checks process to take better account of mental health care as well.
Yep.
I think it's really interesting that you guys are focusing this discussion on mass shootings.
Because that's why I said we have to have two discussions.
Yeah.
Right.
But mass shootings is one of the two.
The point that's there in my head is that worry about mass shootings is, as far as I can tell, a predominantly US way of framing the debate or way of framing part of the debate, because they don't happen in other places.
Right, because you guys tend to have... they don't happen as often, and it's because I think you guys tend to have, outside of the US, better social programs and a bigger focus on that kind of thing.
But that's
in the US, and we value it really after the 80s. Was really when the budget started getting cut for that kind of things. And I think you're seeing the people that grew up in those conditions now turning of an age where this is happening.
Two things
that were related to that act before you go on as well is that there are mass attacks, might not be shootings. I mean, look at the spate of school attacks in China that happened, right? I mean, with knives. And to your point, Jeremy, you know, just look at the number of schizophrenic homeless people on the streets in the US. This is a good indication of some of those budget cuts. But anyway, carry on.
Right, yeah. No, so I grant you that there's definitely an approach of attempt to treat the mental health problems that cause people to do this. I agree with you. But as I say, this conversation doesn't come up in the UK at all because there's no access to guns. Mass shootings just don't happen. Like, at all. In the last 20 years, there have been two, and I can name both of them. You guys have had 11 this year.
It's really similar in a lot of ways to Canada, where there are actually more guns per person than in the United States.
Yeah, just I mean, gonna that, throw that out there. I think,
it's a social issue.
That's why I don't think this one's a gun control issue at all. I think it's a social issue.
If we're talking about mass shootings,
If you look at...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Brad.
No, go for it, Jeremy. You're doing awesome.
I was going to say, if you look at mass shootings, right, they're rare and they should have a fairly fixed average rate over time, so they should be kind of a Poisson distribution. And in the last couple of years, we've fallen outside of that. So I think you have to look for, it's statistically relevant that these have gone up recently, and I think guns have not become more prevalent recently. If you look at guns in the last 50 years in the U.S., ownership's down in between 15% and 20%. So that's why I don't think this is a gun problem. It's a social
there's
problem.
Not a direct correlation between gun ownership debate. And mass shooting violence. At least not within the United States.
Right.
Correct.
I agree that if you draw graphs, they wouldn't necessarily have the same slope. But if you take gun ownership down to a first approximation zero, like England has, then you don't get any mass shootings, also zero. Those things are correlated.
That's like saying if you take it down to the point where no one has cars, then there's no car accidents. I mean, of course.
But I agree with
you. People will still find ways to get drunk and stumble into the gutter and crack their head open. I mean, it's bad things are still going to happen to people. It's just we need to figure out what the root causation for things is and address the root causation directly instead of addressing the kind of surrounding issue. And in this particular case, I think what we've got is we've got potentially kids who are going into school and doing mass shootings, and they're troubled kids who need help. And those kids were going to probably act out anyway. Now, can they do more damage with a semi-automatic firearm than they can with a steak knife from their kitchen? Absolutely. But they can still do a heck of a lot of damage with a steak knife. I don't want them going in and killing one or two kids, let alone 50. So we need to address the social issues and the mental health care issues to make sure that those happen as rarely as possible so we keep all the kids safe, not just by taking guns off the street. Another general thought is there is a big difference between the U.S. and England. In the U.S., there's an ingrained culture of we need our firearms to protect ourselves from our potential imperial overlords. And in the old days, that was England. Whereas England was coming at it from the point of view of we need to be able to oppress our colonies and make sure that they are not armed. We need to make sure that the people do not have access to firearms because that allows a citizen militia to form up and it makes those sorts of problems very, very difficult on a monarchy. So the United States has an ongoing long-term need. Like it's more of an emotional thing, perhaps in many ways, to keep access to those firearms to keep us safe. And at least that's how we perceive it. So it's very difficult to take the guns away from the Americans or the Canadians who really think that
I very much agree with Brian on that.
I freely grant that. More importantly, and not only do I freely grant that point, I think the gun control agenda in the United States is quite disingenuous. I mean, the Second Amendment, this shouldn't be an argument or this shouldn't be a discussion about whether it's legal to possess guns in the US, because it is, right? The Second Amendment is, the first bit's no miracle of clarity, but the second bit, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, right?
Yeah, sure.
I think the gun control agenda in the US is trying to find a way of stopping people from having guns without repealing that amendment because they're too chicken shit to bring that discussion to the table. I'd like to see them say we should repeal that. No, bear with me, because Brian, I absolutely grant your point that in the days of George Washington and George III, a citizen militia was approximately as well armed as the tyrannous Albion government that was oppressing them. However, one guy in a Dodge Durango with a semi-automatic firearm is now not up against a redcoat with a musket rifle. He's now up against someone with stealth bombers. It's not clear to me that your citizen militia will do a great deal.
And yet uprisings like Libya and Egypt still happen successfully.
So here's the thing, right?
But then look at Ruby Ridge, right?
But hang on a second. I've moved from England to America, right? And I've seen firsthand the cultural differences on this topic. And what's interesting to me is, I'll be honest with you, I don't like guns. I don't like anything to do with guns. I don't like the concept. I wish they'd never been invented, right? But I accept the fact that they are invented. That largely, frankly, is because of my English heritage. We don't have the need for guns in England generally. But what's interesting is coming over here to the US and seeing this debate erupt. People are insanely protective of their guns, right? I mean, the levels that people will go to, like, have just astonished me. But to me, it's got nothing to do with this whole protecting yourself from the government. Because I used to share your viewpoint, Ak, which is, that's just such a stupid idea. You're never going to be able to protect yourself against a government that's got the tools, the biggest military in the world. The issue here is not about protection against the government, in my mind. It's about America's unbending addiction to freedom. It's that I should have the freedom of speech, should have the freedom of firearms, and nothing should get in the way of that. And, you know, it's about protecting freedom at all costs. And the thing that disappoints me about this topic is that it's... there's many attributes here, right? I'm sure that people who play violent video games, like, Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook, he was known to be really into some of the shooters and also Dance Dance Revolution, weirdly. But you know, video games play an influence.
I think that's more of the problem.
Movies and films play an influence. Well, the access to firearms does play an influence, but the way it's presented in the US is you're either an insane NRA-supporting gun nut or you're a bleeding heart liberal. And that's the disappointing fact, I think, of this debate everywhere. And when we release this show, there'll be a massive argument in our community between those two different camps as well.
Yeah.
I think the people that want to completely get rid of guns in the US don't realize that realistically, that's, I don't think, a tenable solution, right? Because if the United States have proved anything, it's that prohibition doesn't work. They made alcohol legal, and it certainly didn't stop people from drinking. And
I think Americans, if you make all guns illegal,
people think like all guns will just go away. They'll disappear magically, and no one will have them. Well, that's demonstrably not true. So while ideal, maybe, from a crime perspective, I think you're dealing with false pretenses and an unrealistic expectation. That's why, like I said, I'm a pragmatist. I want real-world solutions.
One of the things that happens when you make decisions like that is that public opinion changes. If you look at the death penalty in Germany, I believe the German government abolished the death penalty in about 1980 or 1990. I forget exactly when it was. It might be in the 70s. But in the teeth of huge public opposition, something like 80, 90% of people thought the death penalty should be kept and it was a good idea. 10 years after they'd made that change, public opinion had swayed massively in the other direction. So now it's not tenable to contemplate bringing it back. Now, I think some of the I grant your point, Jeremy. Absolutely, that at the moment a good portion of public opinion is against it, and it's difficult to make decisions in that kind of environment. But I wonder how many people would say, "Well, we have to have guns back 50 years from now, if you abolish them today."
You may very well be right on that. I want to make one very quick point to kind of tie this in with all of our massive nerdiness that the four of us share here. A lot of the gun debate within America is really not that dissimilar to the free software and open source movement. What we're talking about here is, do we relinquish our control and our freedoms and our rights to another body who has control over us? Do we want to be only able to buy closed source operating systems running on closed source laptops with closed source firmware? Or do we want complete freedom to do what we want with the materials that we want and possess? Something is very similar to owning, possessing, and being well-trained to utilize firearms? Do we want to be able to have the freedom to say no to an oppressive regime that may come in at some point and say that we have to do things their way? How far does that freedom need to go?
Honestly,
can we just say freedom in software or freedom in physical goods as well?
You know, right, Snowden comes out and says, hey, guess what? The NSA are tapping all of your phones, right? They're reading all of your mail. They're implanting bugging devices in your computer when you bought them, right? How is that not at least a tiny bit of an oppressive regime? And how much has having a pistol protected you from it? Oppression's not the way oppression's not done the way George III did it.
No, perhaps not. But, if available, regimes do it. And to be honest, Americans are not exactly pro the NSA tapping everyone. Everyone's upset about it. There's very few people that are like, yay, that's what I wanted. So it really comes back down to a culture of really, like you said, or like one of you guys said, kind of just almost being insanely addicted to freedom. And we're just simply not willing to give up that freedom.
The thing is, as an example, my brother-in-law, Adam, and my father-in-law, Joe, they're both big hunters. They're really into hunting. They're really into guns. Both of them own multiple guns, right? And they are incredibly safe with guns. Like, Adam, he brought a gun over to my house a few weeks. He just bought a new gun. We had a family get-together. He brought it over to show his dad. And, you know, even though he knew that gun wasn't loaded, he didn't point it at anyone. He checked the chamber first. He was very, very safe. Almost paranoid about the safety, which is good. Part of me thinks he should be allowed to have that. If he's a safe, responsible individual, he should be allowed to have that and have that gun and enjoy shooting and hunting or whatever else. But on the other hand, something does need to be done about this. 31 shootings is ridiculous. And that's where I think I'm with Jeremy, which is the issue here really isn't the guns. The guns are just the tools to they're just the instruments of the death and the destruction. They're not necessarily just the cause of it.
Right.
And we need a more cohesive discussion around it. And that's where the discourse is, for me, unsettling, is that it turns into these insane camps. As far as I'm concerned, the quote-unquote NSA nut jobs and the bleeding heart liberals, they're both as bad as each other.
Yeah. I don't think Adam's the exception. That's his thing. I think people that own guns legally are very, very responsible with them. It's the people that own guns illegally that tend to be irresponsible with them. And I think it's disappointing to me that on the other side, the people that own guns illegally is something we should be focusing on significantly more and don't.
Last episode of Bad Voltage, we did the first part of our massive 2014 predictions segment. And being as it is closing...
It was huge.
Now, Jeremy and Jono gave their predictions, probably wildly inaccurate. And being as it is almost February now, we figured it's probably time to wrap up those predictions before it gets too far into the year and we have an unfair advantage. So today, me and Stu, Big Stu, is going to give his predictions and I'm going to give my predictions. Now, I've been informed that we have rules that we have to adhere to for these predictions. Stu, what are our rules?
Absolutely, you have to adhere to rules. Specifically, you have to adhere to one rule, which is that your prediction has to be verifiable. At the end of the year, when we do a show where we review these predictions, there has to not be an argument about whether you got it right or not. So you can't say this thing will become more popular, because that doesn't mean anything.
Or you couldn't use the word underwhelming, for example.
You've got to come up with something.
So many of my predictions now out the window.
Independently testable, please. Right?
All right. I will come up with updates to my predictions on the fly, and you will see 1 year from today that they will still be wildly inaccurate. Stuart, you can go first. What are your predictions for 2014, my friend?
Right. So, first prediction for 2014. I think at least one elected politician in a Western country will publicly announce that they're accepting campaign donations in Bitcoin.
Now, wait a minute here. Are you saying, what defines a Western nation for you?
Right. Okay. I'm trying to
things are topsy turvy on your side of the pond, my friend. I need to be clear.
Yeah.
On
that. No. The point of this exercise is that if we get to the end of the year and you guys say, no, that hasn't happened, and I say, no, one guy in Zambia did it, you'll say, that doesn't count.
Correct. Right? That would be absolutely accurate.
So, but France counts, you know, right?
Elected. Someone who's sitting in government, right?
Yes. Sitting in government and who isn't run out of town for saying the word Bitcoin.
Right. So basically what you're saying is somebody who isn't in a rubbish country, who's in government, will accept Bitcoin.
Yes.
Now, do we have to verify that he actually received...
And now the protests from Zambia complaining about bad voltage come in.
Bring it on. We're armed. now, does he have to actually receive, he or she, receive Bitcoin donations? Or does he just have to be willing to accept
them? No. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if this is done to... pander to a hopefully technological elite in their constituency, and it turns out that elite doesn't exist. Wouldn't surprise me in the slightest.
Don't you think that prediction will only happen if my Bitcoin prediction also happens?
Well, then we both get to win, Jezza.
All right.
No, this is why I will be gleefully gleefully victorious when we get to 2015, when you're both wrong.
All right. So I've got one of my predictions dovetails on this rather nicely. Now I'm going to have to update it on the fly to not use wishy-washy words and be verifiable, because as I wrote it in my notes here, Bitcoins will become almost unusable either by laws and regulations or by continued instability. Let's just say that the market for Bitcoin will be a small fraction of what it currently is. Let's say, 20% of the current total value of Bitcoin will be the Bitcoin market a year from now, either because rules and regulations, the actions of banks towards Bitcoins and Bitcoin merchants, or because of the continued instability and the ups and downs of Bitcoins, people are just going to abandon it.
Or possibly just that everyone gets bored of it, which I think is quite likely.
That is an entirely reasonable scenario, yeah.
Dogecoin will finally take over.
I was going to say, everyone will have moved to Dogecoin.
Well, the absolute beauty of my politician thing is I think they could both be right. I could absolutely imagine the whole current Bitcoin-using world gets jarred off and walks away from it, and just as the whole thing craters and becomes pointless, some politician goes, hey, I accept Bitcoins, and then gets laughed at.
You know what? I think it could be actually a combination of the two. There'll be some hugely unliked politician comes out in favor of Bitcoins, and then everyone walks away from it because they don't want to be associated.
This is the beauty of it. Yes.
All right, Rob Ford. The path is forward for you. All right. So what's up next? What's up next?
What do you guys do?
Me next. Right. Another verifiable prediction. A pure electric car, not a hybrid, will become one of the top 10 selling cars somewhere. In some kind of sensible territory, right? So probably a country, again, probably Western democracy sort of thing. So I don't win if it becomes a top 10 selling car in Chicago because it's not big enough.
Right, this is a country.
Right, yeah. But the point is that I think it would be reasonable if it happened in mainland Europe, but in no individual country or something like that. You know, the point is something you can point out.
It says here,
and say,
sensible here is, territory.
Yeah, here is a top 10 list of car sales somewhere. That somewhere is something that you guys aren't going to argue about, and there's an electric car on that list.
I think this one's inevitably correct, but not in 2014.
But hang on a second.
That's why it's an interesting prediction.
I want to make sure that I can nail you to the cross when we get to 2015. So are we talking about, taking America as an example, you're saying it will be Northern America? Right? It would be the United States of America, right? More specifically.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be... It's in the top 10 list in, for example, California.
Well, I mean, if some kind of big state like Texas, it happens. It's not going to happen in Texas. But if it happens somewhere big like Texas, I think I'd claim a moral victory, right?
There is no moral victory in bad voltage.
No, yeah, we don't do morals.
We'd have to have morals to have moral victories, I guess.
My intention is if I just said it'll become one of the top 10 selling cars, I could say, look, on this street in Phoenix, it's the case. Therefore, it's okay. That's what
I'm trying to avoid. In Elon Musk's house, it's the number one selling
car. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and numbers 2, 3, and 4. That's what we're trying to avoid, right?
All right, fair enough.
You know, if it comes up for California, I think that might be reasonable.
You can have a moral victory for a state, but a territory is a continent or a country.
It should really be a country.
Yep.
Yes. All right. I agree with that.
I would accept Brianna, a state, and that would work for me.
Yeah.
Goodbye. All right. Goodbye. So here we go. I think that 1 year from now, probably by a year from now, maybe a little earlier, 3D printers will become roughly as accessible as normal on paper printing was in the very early 1980s. And by that specifically, I mean, if you live in a major city, you can go to a store and buy a 3D printer for a price that, while your wife will get a little cranky with you, is completely affordable and reasonable to purchase for a nerdy person. I'm pretty confident that that will be happening over the course of the next year.
So you're saying that 3D printers will become essentially
consumer
adopted
goods
by the early adopters and consumers. Like, you'll be able to go and buy one, not for an insane amount of money, and it will be commonplace in society for people who are relatively savvy with technology, as it was in the 80s. With
Bingo.
Printers.
You may not be able to go into your local Staples and pick one up, but there will at the very least be in every major city some sort of specialty shop or a technology shop that will carry at least one model of semi-affordable 3D printer.
I think that's a fair prediction. I mean, I think it's galactically incorrect, but it's verifiable. So well played.
I think it's going to be 2015 when that's going to happen.
I am predicting it because I want it. So I figure if I put that out in the universe with enough gusto and testosterone, it'll just inevitably happen. That's how I go about
that's
my
the
life.
Way, that's the way it works in my experience.
That's how it's been. America. All right, I got one more quick prediction for you guys. I think, so over the course of 2014, we're going to see a number of Linux-powered phones ship from a variety of vendors, many. And I think every single one of them will have incredibly underwhelming sales numbers, even based on the predictions of the vendors who produced them.
And you're excluding Android
give us some
from
specifics.
This,
I'm not including
Android in this list. I think Android's doing fine.
So you're talking about Ubuntu, Firefox,
Tizen,
Nego,
whatever.
Tizen.
Yes.
Right. Oh, that range. Yola, that kind of stuff. Okay.
All of them.
Underwhelming.
Every single one
fuzzy
of them will fall short of internal and published external expectations from the companies, and well below the hopes and dreams of all good Linux nerds everywhere.
Right. You're not going to get any published expectations. You might have internal expectations, but check it out. They're internal, right? So give us something more specific around this. Why don't we do this? Why don't you say that? Would you think it would be, would your prediction be similar to your 3D printing one, which is that you know, a reasonable proportion of society is going to have them? Or would you say that we won't even be at that point?
I don't think we're going to be anywhere
near
that point.
They won't even crack like the top 5 sales of phone OSs or something like that.
I'm willing to go on record and say that we're not going to even crack with one of those phones the top 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that makes me sad on the inside. The 3D printer one makes me happy. The phone one makes me sad. Oh, but I still believe that they will happen.
It's pretty amazing that your audience is so filled with Linux people. Do you feel like you may be losing your audience with this prediction?
I don't want to paint you in a bad way. That's what he thinks is going to happen.
Hey, I'm going to be straight on this.
I don't want to paint you as, you know, like...
If there was an OpenSUSE phone coming out, well, the story may be a little different. But what can you do?
It's available on a Nokia 3210. I don't want to paint you as a false prophet or anything like
you
that.
You sure
but,
don't.
You know,
you really, really don't. That's a thing
I guess
you just don't want to do.
Your audience will be the decider. I predict that sales of your books is going to dramatically decrease in the next couple of months.
All right, you know what? Yeah, all right. You know what? Let's put a stake in that one, too. Is that an official Jono prediction?
No.
Bonus
no, I think
prediction.
Brian Lynch is going to do very well.
Bring the rain, Jono.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's not, oh, by the way, Brian, while I think about it, there's a hand there feeding you. You should try good and hard to bite it.
Brian Lundick will be successful in 2014 because we fucking made you, Lundick.
Hey, man, I don't go around lying to my audience. I tell them like it is. The truth comes out of this big giant word hole.
I tells it like it is. All right. So
on that note.
All right. So, yeah, on that note, folks, go and go to community.badvoltage.org. Go and share your thoughts. We've got a thread up there where everyone's collating their 2014 predictions. Go and tell everyone what you think about Brian and Axe thoughts.
Also, call Axe Stew.
And that wraps up what we hope is another informative, educational, but entertaining episode of Bad Voltage. Anything else to add, guys?
It's nice to have also, James.
Seriously. I put in like three like different types of recordings before we did that one, and they were all bam, banging awesome. And then you come out with that? You come out with that, boy?
Yeah, so bit of background for this. We've tried recording this outro. What, this is the fourth take?
Yeah,
Brian
something like
had
that.
The responsibility to record it. Brian fucked it up every single time, okay? So Jeremy massively. Came in with that, which is very... Yeah.
I tried to take the opposite tact of yours.
Fair enough. Yeah, mine didn't work, so why not?
But Brian, you did make a good point, though, that everything we've talked about in the show is not going to happen, is not going to come true, is completely fictional. So we should maybe come back with the next show with some actual
that
reality.
That might as well be the title of this episode, Not Gonna Happen.
Not gonna happen.
Nothing that's actually what I'm calling is going to happen.
No, but here's the sweet thing, right? We should say that we're going to call it Not Gonna Happen, but that should also not happen. We should call it something else.
Would be apropos,
dude. We are so meta.
So reeling it back in here, if you have any feedback for us, head over to community.badvoltage.org and let us know what you think. Like we said in one of the previous segments, we do want to hear what your predictions are, but we also would like just general feedback on the show, what you think, how we can improve, because clearly there is some room for improvement here, and any other thoughts that you might have.
Yeah, and you know, and also like we try to touch on some big topics on the show, and we can never get through it, but the discussion on the forum is often really interesting to continue that. We touched on guns today, and that's a huge topic. So go there, share your thoughts on that as well. So anyway, yep, we'll see you on the next lovingly crafted artisanal version.
No one's ever going to tune in again, Jono. We suck at podcasting.
We've rebranded. We're artisanal now. We're going to be incredibly popular and way more expensive. Artisanal?
We don't want to pod fade as well. So, all right.
Thanks for listening.